Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
So we have some big news in the automotive industry because Jeep just launched the all-new Cherokee. I shouldn't say launched, more like teased, right?
We know what it looks like, especially from the front end. They showed us a couple pictures. We know that it's going to have a hybrid powertrain. That's about all we know at the moment, but it does look good.
And it might have a 4-liter inline six.
Yeah, it probably won't.
You don't think so?
Or solid axles. I kind of doubt it, but it does look cool. I think it looks a lot better than the previous Cherokee, which one of our videographers used to have.
Yeah, so the Jeep Cherokee, this is a tough car to design because there is one generation of Cherokee that is so iconic, you can't beat it.
And people love XJs, ourselves included. Tommy owned an XJ. Mm-hmm. Was that the only one that the company's had?
We've only had the one.
That's a bit of a crime.
Yeah.
A bit of a shame. We did have a Comanche, which is XJ-ish.
But I was thinking about this case. Why do you think the XJ has so much enthusiast love around it that vehicles like the Chevy Blazer, the vehicles like the first-gen Ford Explorer don't have surrounding them? Isn't that interesting?
I think it's a combination of things. For one, solid axles, which off-road we love, as do many other people. Mm-hmm. The 4-liter straight six, like me saying it or not, that 4-liter straight six, pretty solid engine. I know there's a lot of people out there that just refuse to believe the idea that there is such a thing as a reliable Jeep. That 4-liter is a good motor. Endless modifiability, so any kind of parts that you want to get for them. And this is probably the biggest one. They made so many of them. Mm. So there's tons of them out there, lots of parts out there. And people put them on 1-ton axles. They put them on 44s. People swap LSs into them, lockers, of course, and turn them into absolute monsters. So the XJ is really cool. In stock form, it's just a nice, relatively compact, simple, decently reliable, and still pretty rugged SUV. So whatever direction you want to take it, XJ's right there with you.
I do think it's really interesting. So, like, Jason Kamisa did this big thing on Hagerty about the XJ, and it was really well done, and he talked about, you know, the packaging and engineering that made it better than, like, a Blazer or Bronco 2, right? And I get that. But when you look beyond that at, like, kind of the cult status of that car, right, beyond just the fact, like, the 4-liter was very powerful and it had four doors, right? I mean, it's pretty interesting that, like, that first-gen Ford Explorer is not that far of a departure from a first-gen XJ. I mean, you could even argue the styling is pretty similar. Yeah. And they also sold a bajillion first-gen Explorers, but there's not the same kind of cult excitement around those boxy Fords that there is around those Jeeps.
I agree. And I think maybe the lack of part availability for those Explorers is more of an after effect of the popularity of the XJ. I think the popularity of the XJ came first and then a lot of the aftermarket parts. So I don't know that that was necessarily the reason that they have the cult status that they do, but it is interesting. I think the solid axle thing goes a long way.
Yeah, especially from an off-road standpoint. Now let's kind of talk about this new one. And Cole, I have a challenge for you, our producer. If you go to one of the Jeep social pages, like Instagram or Facebook or whatever, you might be able to play the teaser that they dropped for this car. And it's really interesting because when the Jeep Cherokee went away in 2001, it was replaced by the Liberty, which is one of my favorite cars that Case absolutely hates. But the Liberty was problematic for a lot of different ways, right? And then the new Cherokee came out, I don't know, about 10 years ago, and it was very different. But look at this ad, okay? Mm-hmm. So we're watching the ad. teasing the new Cherokee. Look how much they are leaning into the heritage here.
Yeah, they showed a couple SJs even, so some older Cherokees, original Cherokees, which is pretty cool. But they are. They're showing a lot of the boxy Cherokees. I saw very briefly. Oh, yeah. There you could see it for a moment. One of the previous generation Cherokees that's been discontinued for a couple of years now. But they're mostly showing images of the old school SJs and XJs.
It is so funny kind of seeing the marketing push on this. Because when the last Cherokee came out, they didn't really do that, I don't believe, right? They really kind of steered away because it was such a radical departure in design. Our buddy Mark Allen was the head of Jeep design at the time, and he did this crazy thing where he, you know, separated the turn signal from the headlights, which people hated 10 years ago.
Yeah, it wasn't my favorite thing either, but to your point, it was a radical departure, and it kind of took the Cherokee name into a very different direction. So it seems like with this Cherokee, they're maybe trying to steer back towards the big, boxy, traditional Cherokees of the past. Mechanically, underneath, especially since we know this is going to have a hybrid powertrain, I still think it's going to be fairly modern. As much as you would like to see your 4-liter and your solid axles, I would too. That's obviously not going to happen. I'm sure it's going to be fully independent suspension. This is a more compact machine, but that doesn't mean they can't make it pretty capable. And even the previous generation Cherokee that this is stepping in for afterwards, That Cherokee actually, especially what in Trailhawk form, mm-hmm. had some pretty decent capability.
We'll talk about that a little later in the podcast when we get to the headline, which is most overrated and also underrated off-roaders. But so our friend Sam, you know Sam, he's a longtime journalist and engineer, and he's a host at the Wheel Bearings podcast, great guy. He sent me an email after he watched our video on this car, and he said it may not have a 4-liter, but what if it had a Hurricane?
That would be interesting. Turbo. Yeah, how would I? It doesn't look like an incredibly long hood.
You would have to make it transverse.
Yeah, which
a transverse Hurricane.
I don't know if they have a configuration for that.
That'd be sick. By the way, why does the Wrangler not have a Hurricane?
That would be interesting, especially in place of the Pentastar. Pentastar is a decent motor. We've got no problem with it. It's been around for a long time. It's a good solid workhorse. They're pretty dependable. We've seen them at very high miles.
Yeah.
But it's not an exciting engine, nor is it one that's got a lot of bottom-end torque. And I personally, in an SUV especially, really like low-end torque. I don't want to be sitting there on the highway in an SUV doing, you know, 50 miles an hour at 5,500 RPM continuously. So something like the Hurricane, if you could spec that on a Wrangler instead of the Pentastar, that would be sweet.
That would be sick. I mean, look, they have the 2-liter 4-cylinder, which is fine. Mm-hmm. They're also called the Hurricane, which is confusing. let's name two different engines the same word. Same architecture, I think. Then you've got the plug-in hybrid, which is fine. But like the Wrangler, in this JL generation, they've had V6 4-cylinder turbo, 4-cylinder turbo hybrid.
Six-cylinder diesel. And the 392.
And the American V8. So it kind of makes sense. Like, clearly this platform can take
pretty adaptable
variety of options, right? And it's a pretty long hood. I bet they could get a 3-liter under that hood.
I'm sure they could too. And I hope that's something that they do. I believe that would benefit the Wrangler quite a bit because obviously that space is pretty competitive and it stays competitive. Mm-hmm. 4Runner is recently updated. The Bronco has a lot going for it over the Jeep. So if they were to introduce the Hurricane as an option,
it might
bring a little extra life into the lineup.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I think a lot of people miss the V8 that's gone, right?
Definitely.
I mean, honestly, and I still think this is a big marketing blunder, the thing that would have really crushed Bronco, so like Jeep had the Wrangler all to that category all to themselves for decades, right?
Yeah.
The last Bronco was like 95 or something, 96. That was a very different beast. But let's say 96 was the last Bronco, right? Then Jeep had 96 through 2021, right? And they had the TJ Wrangler, which was pretty cool and sold really well. They had the JK Wrangler, which was pretty cool, sold well. They had the JL Wrangler, and then Bronco came out, right? And then Jeep's response to the Bronco was the 392, which was awesome. But it was also $100,000.
Yeah.
And what they should have done is just taken the 5.7 Hemi and put it under the hood of the Wrangler. And then you would have had a much more affordable V8 powered off-roader with a cool exhaust on that thing. That would have been huge.
That's true. That would be interesting and compelling. It would still be expensive.
It would be.
Even we had for a while here at the office as a long-term tester a Wrangler Rubicon that was about as base as you can spec a Wrangler Rubicon. Still had halogen headlights. And I'm trying to remember, because this was now a couple of years ago, did it even have cloth seats?
Yes.
And I want to say it was around 60?
Yeah.
Low 60s?
Maybe, high 50s. It was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. So if you imagine infusing that with a V8, it's still going to be probably 70, 80 grand.
The problem is, and this is the G problem right now, is it doesn't have to be, right? It does not have to be, because I would imagine the development cost for that would be so much less. Because if you look at, like, they already went through the costs to put the 6.4 in, right? The 5.7 is a similar engine architecture.
Yeah.
And if you look at, like, Challenger, Charger, and Chrysler 300, right? Those all have been able to accept Pentastar 5.7 and 6.4 and a 6.2 supercharged.
I'm not saying it would be difficult to put the 5.7 into
it. They would just make it expensive.
But it has to be more expensive than the Pentastar.
Yeah, which is already...
which is already kind of too expensive.
Prohibitively expensive, so. Yeah. But a V8 Wrangler for 45 grand would be awesome.
Is a hilarious thought.
In 2025, yeah.
Because you can barely get a Wrangler for 45 grand.
Yes. Yeah, our bill, our cheap Jeep with no power windows or door locks or mirrors was 37 grand.
Yeah. So closing in on that figure with no options.
Craziness.
Technically, it had some options. It had the automatic. It had the hard top. Those were the two biggest ticket items on that particular Jeep. But the fact that that was closing in on $40,000.
Absurd.
Yeah, the idea of a $45,000 V8 Jeep, I love, but it's also a funny thought in this day and age.
So expect a new Jeep Cherokee likely in 2026, probably 80 to 90 grand starting.
Probably not with a 5.7 Hemi.
Probably not with a 5.7 Hemi.
If it's an e-torque, they said hybrid.
You know what's there interesting? You there you go, e-torque Hemi. What I always find interesting about Stellantis is they have been very successful with very interesting cars, like the Hellcats, like the Wrangler has been very successful, right? Yeah. TRX, very successful. The cars that they struggle with are the non-interesting cars. So, like, think about all of the small crossovers they've tried throughout the years that just aren't very good.
The Hornet.
The Hornet.
Pretty recently.
I would argue the Compass, right? Just not very competitive with their major, especially Japanese rivals. And that was the previous generation Cherokee's problem. Like, it was a fine car, but you're going up against CR-V and RAV4 and Rogue, which do a lot of things just better, and they have that kind of built reliability. This is a very hard segment for them to conquer.
It's definitely a hard segment because it's extremely competitive. But if this, well, what do you think? Is this going to be sized more like a Passport or a Bronco Sport? Because the Passport is bigger than the Bronco Sport.
Can I be honest with you? Yeah. I think of those two as the exact same size. In my head,
they are similar size.
There are so many.
The Passport's definitely bigger.
Okay, that one maybe. But there are so many nitpicky now sizes
of
crossovers.
Like, this is such a massive segment that it gets broken down into all these sub-segments. But basically, the way I see it, if this could be competitive in its running gear and off-road capability, if this could be competitive with the Passport Trail Sport or the Bronco Sport Sasquatch, that would be great. The particular model that we're looking at pictured on screen here, the one that they've shown so far, doesn't seem like the most rugged model that they'll offer, because we don't see recovery hooks up in the front, which we know in the previous generation they did have. And we don't see a very knobby tire. So I don't imagine that this is a Trailhawk type of trim. So I think there will probably be more aggressive versions of the vehicle than this. And if those more aggressive versions could be competitive with that Bronco Sport Sasquatch, the Passport Trail Sport, then I think they could potentially have a winner.
Well, I mean, what just go back to this, because this grinds my gears. If you're a fan of this podcast, check out Carish, which is another podcast.
Where Tommy's gears get ground all the time, usually by kitchen appliances.
Usually by kitchen appliances, that's right. But that's a fun Car-ish podcast called Car-ish.
It sure is.
You can find it on Spotify and podcasts. But, like, so in my mind, does the Bronco Sport compete with the RAV4? Not really, right? But an Escape competes with the RAV4, and a Bronco Sport is the same platform as an Escape. So, like, what?
Yeah, it's tough.
It's a mess.
Because they're all kind of the same.
They're all kind of the same. So moving on to our next news story of the day, which I think is very interesting. Tesla Cybertruck has had a kind of tough year, right?
Yeah.
kind of a tough year. But things don't seem to be getting a lot better. Recent stories have come out that Cybertrucks now are stacking up in huge quantities outside of Detroit.
Yeah.
Which is a little, there's a little bit of kind of poetic justice there after Elon was so confident comparing this to F-150s and Silverados and Rams, right? And
yeah.
Now it's stacking up in parking lots.
There was definitely a big game talked about it. I remember the headline around 1 million reservations. They've sold quite a bit under 1 million of them. And they are stacking up in parking lots, so much so that some, I don't know, municipalities, whatever you want to call them, some areas are not too pleased with all of these metal triangles hanging out in their parking lots.
Yeah, so this is on CarScoops if you want to find out more information. But according to CarScoops, only 40,000 were sold last year, well short of the 250,000 Teslas predicted, according to Forbes. And apparently there's a parking lot outside of Michigan, which is an ex-Bed Bath & Beyond mall, which is also kind of poetic justice that now there's not going to say that. It's not a defunct product, but it is a defunct company, Bed Bath & Beyond, right?
Yeah.
And apparently the city is very unhappy because there's just so many of them. Now, Tesla has just launched a new rear drive Cybertruck to try to get some more interest in them. But things are, to say that it's outperforming any of the big three that's a stretch at this point.
Yeah, it's definitely not outselling the F-150, but there's no surprise there. And that's not to say that we completely dislike the Cybertruck. There are definitely things that vehicle does
very well.
And we tested one for quite a while. But it's definitely an interesting bit of news and a very interesting image seeing all of these brand new Cybertrucks parked door to door in a parking lot as far as the eye can see.
So this got me thinking, with all these unsold Cybertrucks, what could be a good alternative use of a Cybertruck? For example, this is what I'm thinking. That slab-sidedness and the sharp angles. I bet you could stack one on its wheels and another one upside down on the flat surface.
Right. I could see how they would kind of Jenga together.
And then create a miniature Hoover Dam. Now, that is an interesting use of a Cybertruck. If nobody's buying them, let's start using them to make dams.
I've got a more practical use.
What you got?
Using them as batteries.
Okay, that's fine. What about this? A lot of people have compared them to dumpsters. Why don't we just use them as mobile dumpsters? Got a full bed. They're lockable, right? Park these at music festivals and have people throw their trash in
there. Someone's going to drive a Cybertruck through the front of our office.
Also a good use.
No, it's not, Tommy. That's a bad thing.
Very good battering ram.
It does seem like a lot of people have been driving through the fronts of businesses recently.
That does seem to be a big thing, yeah. Comment below.
Mostly in Subarus.
If you've recently driven through the front of a business, drop us a comment below and send us that video.
A Subaru doesn't seem like the best vehicle to do that with.
Like that guy that drove through the dealership in a Subaru?
Yeah.
He was like upset.
I think that happened twice.
Yeah, he bought...
Not the same guy. Different people.
Two different Subarus.
Were they both in the Pacific Northwest where you're from, Cole?
No.
They might have been.
One of them was like, I think, in Salt Lake. And this guy bought a $4,000 Subaru, and then it had problems, and he was upset about the problems, and then drove it through the dealership.
It's a bad way to deal with that.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.
Really held up pretty well.
Because I bet that gave the car even more problems.
So here you go, Utah man. But Utah here's the man. Thing. Look how well that Outback held up.
It does look like it held up pretty well.
Did you see that? Did you see how well that front end took that blast?
So imagine how well a Cybertruck would hold up.
That's what I'm talking about.
Don't drive cars through the fronts of stores.
No, but if you do, drop us a comment below because I'd love to hear about it. We could have the market cornered on people that drive cars.
That's
through
a bad market, Tommy. We need to steer away from that.
I also think that the battery is genuinely a good idea. I said it. Case had a good idea.
Thank you very much.
Case had one.
First one of the day, maybe the week.
But I think the good news about this, if you wanted a Cybertruck, I'm willing to bet you can get a pretty hot deal on one.
Yeah.
I also think that these would be good to park inside of schools, not drive through schools. God, don't drive a Cybertruck through a school. But the sides of these could easily be used as a dry erase board.
Yeah, but they've got a lot of sharp edges.
That's true. You'd have to put like those little like, you know, when you're like kid-proofing a house, you put those little like smudgy things on.
Yeah, or you'd have to dull them, file them down, deburr them a little bit. You almost wonder why they don't do that from the factory. Maybe they'll offer that as an optional extra at some point down the line.
Deburr the Cybertruck, kind of sand down the edges a little bit.
Yeah, so you don't get cut by it.
I mean,
how many people at the office got cut by ours?
A couple. Gavin got really hurt by ours.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you remember? Poor guy, our intern.
Gavin, and then Zach.
Zach got cut by ours.
Cut from one.
Yes. Nathan. Yep. Nathan got. Do you remember like when all those people were doing those videos chopping vegetables?
Oh, God. And one guy who was especially enthusiastic closed his finger in it. He's like, it's fine.
Cole, did you see that video?
And then it wasn't fine.
He wanted to prove that the front trunk would open if it hit his hand. Okay.
And it just cinched down on his finger.
And he's like a big Tesla-like fanboy. And he's like, see, it doesn't hurt. And then he's like, it doesn't hurt that bad. Yeah, it was.
Hey, look, it's Pete Davidson.
Unbelievable piece of video. This is an ABC Chicago video that were pulled up. Yeah, so he puts his hand in the front trunk to prove that the
Cybertruck. Also a bad idea.
Don't do that. Don't drive your Cybertruck through our office or put your hand in the front trunk. So here he goes. Still, he's all happy. He's showing off. Look, banana.
Seems like the banana is fine.
And the banana got crushed in half is what happened. Okay, that time it was fine. So carrot. Carrot got destroyed.
Yikes. So he thinks.
So
finger,
he's gonna do finger
is way different from a carrot.
It's okay. I'm not squeamish. So he's going to put his finger in the hole.
Oh, his whole arm.
Just whole arm. Oh!
Okay, so the arm is fine.
Arm is not cut off.
Yeah, so he put his whole forearm in it, and that seemed fine.
Okay, so now here comes the hand.
This is like his palm.
Okay, here it goes. Oh!
The palm is fine.
Not bad. Oh, this is not the video I was thinking.
Yeah, it must be the wrong video.
The wrong video. Oh, no.
Uh-oh, here goes the finger.
Oh, ooh. God! Oh, oh no! Okay, don't look. Yeah, really not good stuff.
So,
his finger is in bad shape. That's what has happened.
Yeah, so all bad ideas.
Anyway, cooking. Cook your vegetables. Chop the vegetables with the front end.
With the Cybertruck.
And then cook it in the onboard power in the back.
Seems energy inefficient.
So next story I want to talk about. This is actually pretty cool for those of you who are not into Cybertrucks, which is everybody on this podcast. The Toyota Celica might be coming sooner than we think. Recent reports by the Vice President of Planning and Strategy, Cooper Erickson, hinted that it might be an ultralight and advanced internal combustion vehicle.
Which would be pretty cool because we're excited about, for example, like the Prelude name coming back, but I think a lot of people aren't excited about the powertrain on that car being basically the same powertrain you get on the Civic Hybrid, which is not the most compelling, heart-throbbing kind of powertrain. But if they could take a new Celica and make something a little more analog and a little more emotionally stirring with it, that could be pretty exciting.
Yeah, the Prelude. Okay. Here's the thing.
Let's hear it.
I was born in the 90s, but I would not consider myself a 90s baby because
right.
I was three when the 2000s came
Which
around.
Which is fair. So, that Prelude is good looking, though.
It is a very good looking car, but I don't really remember the 90s or the 80s or the 70s. I don't remember the 70s hardly at all.
Weird.
So I don't fully understand the appeal of the Prelude. Because I've seen the old ones and I think they're kind of cool, but they always seem like kind of sporty Civics. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure why people are that excited about them.
Yeah, I think it's a similar feeling to the Miata, where it's a fun car, kind of a slow car fast type vehicle rather than fast car slow. Not that Tommy and I are fast car people at all. In fact, on our last podcast that we recorded earlier today for Car-ish, we were both looking at one of the modern Ferrari, you know, one of 250. We had no idea what it is.
I know what it was. It was an SF90 Sherman.
Yeah, that is what it was. But we didn't get that immediately off the bat. We're not like, yeah, we're not fast car people.
We got it after we were told what it was by our non-car person producer.
But even so, even though we're not fast car people, we're also, I guess we're not slow car people either. Do we like cars at all?
I don't know if we do.
Dang.
What year did the Corvette go from one headlight to two headlights?
1958.
There you go. I got that wrong, and a guy said I am not a car person.
Yeah, that one bit of trivia, you not knowing that, completely negated the over a decade you've been here doing this.
Anyway, if you're looking for an amateur clarinetist, I can drop my resume anywhere you want.
But back to the point of the Prelude and the Celica. Yeah, Tommy and I, we're not huge JDM car guys.
Mm. We're more French car guys, if we're being honest.
Well, you say we. I'm not a French car guy.
You like French cars. What's your favorite French car?
I don't have a favorite, Tommy.
The Citroën?
DS?
DS?
Sure.
There you go. Big French car guy. He said sure.
Huge French car guy. Extremely enthusiastic.
I like Japanese cars quite a bit, but I don't fully understand the culture surrounding Preludes is what I'm trying to say.
Well, especially for the amount of money. I think that's one of the biggest things.
That's because the holdup.
Some of the iconic Integras, Preludes, Celicas, I get it. Yeah, I mean, if it's your dream car, it's... Your dream car is your business, your money, how you spend it, totally up to you. I've poured a bunch of money into an old Land Rover, which is objectively a terrible thing. So, you know, I'm not one to pass judgment. I'm just saying, and I think it's the same for you. It's not our go-to.
And what I'm going with this is I feel kind of the same way about the Celica. So, Cole, look up the all-wheel drive Celica rally car. Remember these?
Mm-hmm.
The quad headlight turbo machines. So when I think of Celica, like the GT4s are freaking rad, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now look up like a 1995 base model Celica. And this is also what comes to mind. Like a lot of Celicas were kind of just, look at that machine, right?
Yeah.
A lot of Celicas in my mind aren't performance cars at all. Oh, look at that egg.
That doesn't scream performance to you?
123 horsepower. So, like, this is the Celica I think of when I think of Celicas. Mm-hmm. And the ones I see are, like, they're kind of like Corolla coupes. And that just doesn't get me going.
Understandably so. But I got to give Toyota credit because one thing that they've done really well in the past several years is their enthusiast cars.
Yes.
So, GR86. Mm-hmm. Not only the Supra, but bringing the manual transmission to the Supra, the GR Corolla. We've got a wealth of some pretty fantastic performance cars, driver's cars from Toyota here in the States, even a couple others abroad, GR Yaris.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. No, they're killing cool stuff.
So if they do that same thing with the Celica here, then it's got a lot of potential.
And I'm not complaining about a new Celica. I'm dead excited about it. I think it's going to – the more enthusiast cars, especially if it's potentially ultralight and internal combustion, this could be freaking awesome. So I think that there's really big potential for a very, very cool car here.
But I guess the bigger point that we were very slowly wandering toward is that we're not like massive Celica people as it stands.
The best Celica is the Celica Supra, which is a Supra.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
What it became.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I just think it's important to keep some of these nameplates in perspective a little bit. But look, I'm all for it. I hope they do it really well. I mean, I would imagine they're probably going to maybe keep it front wheel drive with like that if they are able to utilize that three-cylinder turbo in the
Corolla. Which is fine. Be cool. Imagine if they made a Celica that went after the Civic Type R.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
That would be so cool. Cool. Yeah. So hopefully they do it right. And I'm happy the Prelude's coming back. To your point, that new Prelude, even though I'm kind of unsure about the powertrain, the design is amazing.
The design's awesome. Yeah. And if at some point down the line they play around with the powertrain on the Prelude a little bit, then that could turn into something really cool as well.
So, Cole, look up a picture of our next story, the Kia Tasman. Mm. Now,
what's going on with the Tasman now?
A great question. The CEO of Hyundai in Australia went and said that apparently they're building an actual Hyundai pickup. And I don't mean like a Santa Fe. I mean a truck. So kind of interesting right? Now, I spent some time with the sister, I would assume the sister of this car, which is called the Kia Tasman, which is an absolutely crazy design. It kind of looks like your truck.
So, well, no, but so you're thinking the Tasman could turn into the Hyundai truck that maybe we'll see here in the States?
Yeah, I really actually think that a Hyundai truck would be quite popular. So the Kia Tasman is a body-on-frame truck that competes with like the Ranger. It's an actual mid-sized truck with a solid rear axle. It's got locking differentials.
Yeah. So again, not like the Santa Cruz.
Not at all. But I think that a Hyundai version of this could be popular in the States. I don't think the Tasman will be popular in the States. You know why?
The way it looks?
It's horrible.
So you've seen one in person because you, were you in Korea?
I was in Korea.
Yeah.
And it is one of the strangest looking vehicles ever. It looks like a turtle in the front.
Yeah.
And then it's got water wings in the back.
And you think that looks like my Cummins?
A little bit.
Okay.
Well, okay, hear me out. So the Cummins...
I stopped listening immediately.
The Cummins is known for that like Kenworth design.
Yeah.
Where you have the headlights down low.
The Louisville Slugger.
The Louisville Slugger. And then you got the elevated grill. Kia Tasman.
It does have headlights and a grill, I grant you.
Yep, yeah, but look at that curve on the hood. That's just a 12-valve Cummins look. Eh? Maybe.
That's a tough pitch, Tommy. That's not the hill to die on.
But the truck... in my opinion, is not a looker. It had amazing interior. It was very, very well cushioned and padded and had all sorts of really cool tech in it. You could have it with a diesel engine and a manual transmission, which would never come to the States, but should. So I think the truck itself was actually cool. I just think that Americans could not get past the look. But Hyundais don't always look like the Kia counterparts.
That's true.
So it could be kind of cool.
Sometimes they style them very differently.
What do you think of that Ranger HD truck?
The Ranger HD is super cool. We had the Ranger Raptor for a while, and we loved the Ranger Raptor. It was one of our favorite pickup trucks. Definitely my favorite truck of the year last year. Maybe probably one of my favorite trucks we've ever had, especially price considered. $55,000 for a Ranger Raptor is not a tiny amount of money. But for what you get, lockers, a lot of power, a lot of torque, great suspension, not too bad. But that's not it.
It would be sick if it was. Look at that dually Ranger. So, there you go. They can do that Motor Trend article.
So here it is. So for other markets, though, they showed off this upcoming Ranger Super Duty. And this is possibly even cooler than the Ranger Raptor.
You think it's cooler?
I think so because here's what makes it cool. The Ranger Raptor sacrifices a fair amount of utility in order to be a purely off-road truck. A high-speed, desert-running, long-suspension travel, wide-body, off-road truck. This actually increases the capability of the truck as a utility vehicle, but it still gets you a lot of rugged, off-roady features.
So this is kind of like, I think it's a wider track than a standard Ranger. It's got box flares.
It's also, I think it's an 8-lug.
Which is crazy for a mid-sized truck.
Check that out. Zoom in on there.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Yes, 8-lug.
So they beefed up a lot of the running gear substantially so, and you've still got enough rugged accessories on it that you could take it down some pretty gnarly tracks. That's cool.
This would never come to the U.S., so you know why?
Because it's too cool?
Because it's too cool, no, because it would take sales away from the F-150. And I kind of see why this makes sense in Australia, because there are probably some instances like where you need the smaller size, but you still want some more capability. Like I think it tows 8,000 or 9,000 pounds. It's a huge amount. But in the US, if you want more capability, you just get a bigger truck, right? You get a bigger footprint.
That's always the answer.
But it is a pretty cool looking.
It's a very cool truck.
It's got a snorkel on it too. It's got, it's got some heavy duty bumpers on that thing. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Really cool.
Yeah. Super cool.
So transitioning now to the topic of today. The discussion. I thought it'd be interesting. Kiss and I were having a long talk in the car the other day about some four-wheel drive off-road machines that are so overhyped. We think they're a little overrated.
Yeah. And the thing about this too, which also makes it worth talking about, is that overrated is usually accompanied by overpriced. And underrated is usually accompanied by underpriced. So it could be some potentially useful consumer advice, or Tommy and I are just completely deluded and dumb and wrong. Also possible.
Probably true.
It depends on what vehicles we're about to bring up, because like with many vehicles, like with sports cars, like with pickup trucks, like with motorcycle brands. People are very cultish.
They are cultish. And I'm going to lead off with the vehicle I think is most overrated. And now this is when the Cybertruck's going to come shooting through the office. Is the 200 series Land Cruiser. Dun, yeah. Dun, dun, dun. Yes. I know. Case is looking for the ballistic missiles coming at us here. So we've owned 200 series Land Cruisers. I spent a lot of time in them. That's the 300 series, Cole. It's the last full, quote-unquote, full-size Land Cruiser sold in the U.S. It was like 07 through 21.
Yeah, I made it for a long time.
So
super long.
First of all, Case, kind of walk us through why people love 200 series.
Well, so there's a lot of sensible reasons to love the 200 series Land Cruiser. The 5.7 iForce V8, especially over time, became a very venerable, durable engine. Pretty decent torque. Of course, these vehicles aren't super fast, but that wasn't really the point. This was also a flagship SUV, so it did come with a lot of comfort, a lot of features, although by the end of the production of this vehicle, it felt pretty dated, but still being a flagship, had some nice niceties going for it and comfort going for it. Very durable running gear. The way that Toyota engineers these vehicles is to an extremely high standard, a much higher standard for durability than usual with the Land Cruiser, especially. A generally versatile and pretty rugged machine, solid rear axle, but independent front suspension, and reasonably good off-road. So those are the reasons that people love them.
Now, okay, Cole.
And a lot of parts that you can modify them with.
Head over to bringatrailer.com, okay? And then in the search bar, look up...
Land Cruiser Heritage?
Land Cruiser Heritage. I think that would be an interesting one that we could maybe showcase, and maybe we'll start to see
my... two words, Land Cruiser.
Yeah, maybe we'll start to see my my reasoning here. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go scroll down. So the last one sold for $120,000, then $73,000, then $91,000, then $95,000. And then how about that 7,000-mile one?
Yeah, let's click on that.
So this is a 2021 Land Cruiser, okay? It's got 7,000 miles on it, so it's a used car.
It is. It is literally a used car.
Granted.
It's 4 years old.
Slightly used.
4 or 5 years old.
Right? Used car. And it sold back in January of this year for $131,000.
Which is a preposterous amount of money.
Yeah. So for basically a stock Land Cruiser with the roof rack, it went for, and it, keep in mind, that's not some dealer asking $131,000.
No, that's that was a bidding war, private seller.
$131,000, right? My problem with 200 series Land Cruisers is they're just not that good, especially the Heritage Editions. Now, I understand the appeal of the Land Cruiser because you kind of talked about the durability.
Absolutely.
Right? And it is true. If you wanted to traverse to all seven continents in the world, you would probably find a 200 series somewhere kicking around.
And we frequently do, right?
That's the problem. I'm sorry, Brad. You don't need a 200 series to go to Starbucks or to go to Uray, right? The issue with Land Cruisers, 200 series Land Cruisers, is like, I know they have that capability and the longevity, but for the average use case in the U.S., it's just not needed.
No, and another thing to this vehicle's credit is that they do hold value really well. This was not a $131,000 vehicle when brand new.
Like 90, maybe they were like 90 grand, I think.
So it proved a very good investment, and there's a case to be made for that. But I also would make a case that if you're an enthusiast buying a vehicle, more so for the vehicle's sake than necessarily a financial investment, because I think in general, if you're trying to invest, you could probably invest in better things than cars.
Yes. That's certified investing advice right there. Don't invest in cars if you want to make money.
If you're spending $131,000 on a Land Cruiser, I'd be willing to wager that in 40 years and at 500,000 miles, you're probably not going to be in that same Land Cruiser, right?
I think you're right. Now, Cole, the average person keeps a car 9 years for the record, and it's like 100,000 miles.
Yeah.
Most cars will make it 9 years and 100,000 miles, modern cars.
Even Land Rovers.
Wow. Well, let's not get too bold here, Case. So, Cole, head back to the main page here and bring a trailer. Just look up URJ 200. Let's just see what like a standard 200 series is going for these days, right? Okay, cool. Let's see some results here. Scroll on down there, Cole. So we've got a 2018 that sold for $54, a $5,000. That's not even a Heritage Edition. Someone spent $106,000 for a standard 2021 Land Cruiser.
Hmm.
That's insane. But even like some of the early ones will still go for $25,000 to $35,000 in some cases, right?
Yeah.
And the problem is, and this is my bigger problem with them, I just don't like driving them. I understand the durability, but I always felt that 200 yeah. series are very, very bloated, right? Especially yeah. on trails.
Yeah. Well, so, because here's an important distinction. And when you're looking at off-roaders, it's not one type of thing that you're looking at. So something like this Land Cruiser would do really well, like we said, overlanding, traversing continents where you're on some rugged roads, but they're roads. What we mostly do, Tommy and I, here in Colorado, is rock crawling, driving up over big, steep, tall boulders. And this versus a Wrangler Rubicon or a Bronco Sasquatch, this is not in the same league
no.
as a rock crawler.
And I know people are going to say, well, of course it's not supposed to. But even if you compared a lifted, built-out 200 series to a bone stock 4Runner, the 4Runner is going to be so much more nimble and agile. And that is an area yeah. of off-roading that people constantly overlook, even if you're not rock crawling, if you're doing forest roads, right? More mild stuff, if you're going through the mud or through the sand, like weight is your enemy of everything. And 200 series are just inherently heavy.
Yeah.
And then people take an already heavy vehicle and they slap on sliders and roof racks and jerry cans and
steel bumpers, winch.
Yeah, exterior mounted spares. And then you end up with 7,500 pounds of pig and 381 horsepower.
Yeah.
Is not enough to get that thing comfortably down the road or a trail.
Yeah, they're definitely a little overweight.
Yeah. And so. I just like the prices, and just keep scrolling down a little, Cole. Like even some of the early ones for 30 grand. Are just like mind blowing. There's a 10,000 mile one that sold for 84. One sold for 82. They're really big money.
Yeah. Point being, even a less durable vehicle, you could probably do quite a bit of maintenance on before still, it costs $131,000.
And also, like, I think for the size of the vehicle, they're pretty badly packaged. Like the third row is kind of cool how it folds up, but it's yeah. also totally impractical for a use case. So look, if you are in the UN, this is not an overrated vehicle. Mm-hmm. If you are looking for an overlander for American roads and,
yeah.
and like the 2 weeks that you got off Brad per year, just any car will be okay.
And look, at the end of the day, this is all just Tommy and I's opinion, all for fun. If a 200 series Land Cruiser is your dream vehicle, then that's a great dream vehicle to have because it's one that's probably not going to require a lot from you other than that upfront investment. But as far as overrated or underrated goes,
overrated.
I'm kind of inclined to agree with you, especially ones that are going for over six figures. I don't see it.
All right, I've got an underrated car now.
Let's hear it.
The 250 series Land Cruiser.
Yeah.
The new Land Cruiser that we get in the U.S.
This is one that Tommy and I were just talking about because this is a vehicle that gets quite a bit of hate, mostly because it's not the 200 series Land Cruiser.
Yes.
But this is a much more compact, much more nimble vehicle, full-time four-wheel drive, which is great. It's a lot more modern. In many ways, it's nicer on the inside than the 200 series is. Because it's recently updated, whereas that 200 series was aging pretty heavily. And I get it, there are limitations to this vehicle and its capability, and maybe there will be some limitations to its longevity, which I think is one of a lot of people's big concerns. But I think we're maybe jumping the gun a little bit because these haven't been around.
They just came out.
Yeah, they haven't been around long enough for us to definitively say, oh, you know, Toyota's longevity and durability has just gone away completely.
And look, so the story behind this is, and this has been the case for decades and decades and decades, just not in the U.S. It's like for years abroad, you have the Land Cruiser, which is 100, 200, 300 series, and then you have the Prado, which is like the 150 and the 250 series, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're a lighter duty application, right? But when you read about these things online, when Land Cruiser people talk about these, it makes it sound like it's made out of little bits of sticks and bubble gum. right? And it's going to be a constant nuisance and it doesn't deserve the name, but it still is a Land Cruiser, right? Yeah. Regardless of what you want to say, it's still TNGAF, which underpins every other Toyota truck at this point now, right? And it's a very, on a trail, I would take this over a 200 series 10 days out of 10 days.
Especially the trails, again, that we have out here in Colorado, where what we're going to be doing is navigating through a lot of times pretty narrow trees, through forests, up and over rocks. This vehicle, like you said, more nimble, much lighter weight. So, yeah, I agree.
And the thing is, it's like dimensionally, they're not that different. The original press release that Toyota came out said that this car was a couple inches shorter than 200 series. But realistically, from a length standpoint, they're not that different. Width, they're a little narrower, like mm-hmm. you said. But they just feel so much more svelte.
They feel a lot more athletic.
Yeah. And also, the other thing too about 200 series, which just drives me crazy, is they have a really high belt line. And they're kind of hard to kind of get a sense out of. Where these 250 series, you got really big windows. You got that low-cut belt line. So it feels much more maneuverable yeah. just from a visibility point.
Yeah, and if you're out there with steam blowing out of your ears and you're red in the face hearing us talk good about the 250 and bad about the 200, we're not saying that the 250 is a definitively better vehicle than the 200.
No.
Just rather saying that this probably gets more hate than it deserves, and the 200 probably gets more love than it deserves.
And at least where we live in Colorado at 6,000 feet above sea level, the 200 series that we owned was kind of a dog. Especially yeah. when you put them on tires, right?
Definitely.
So you hear V8 and you think, oh, that's going to be powerful, right? But this has more torque than the 200 series. Mm-hmm. And yes, it sounds like marbles in a blender.
Yeah, it not doesn't a good sound sounding exceptional.
Engine. But when you're going up by 70, you're not doing 7.5 mpg on the steep parts.
Yeah.
And you are doing 75 miles an hour.
Yeah, you can actually maintain speed at altitude on steep grades, which is great.
With an 8-speed automatic transmission, yeah. So let's go back to another overrated off-roader.
What are you thinking this time, Tommy?
This one's going to be another fight. I know I'm gonna take this one, right? And I will admit there's probably some inherent bias here, but I just can't get into the Subaru thing. And here's the problem. I really like Subarus.
Yeah.
Genuinely. And the story is that Subaru doesn't work with us because of an incident 10 years ago where we took one off-road. And we did put some pinstripes in the paint, right? And then they took it out of our garage. It was a whole thing. I don't want to go into it again. But beyond that, we've owned a bunch of Subarus since then, right?
Absolutely.
And genuinely love a lot of their products. Like Crosstrek, we bought brand new. Fantastic car. Our producer Ian has been driving, or videographer Ian's been now been driving it for 3 years, I think, 70,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is broken. Really good cars. The problem I have with Subarus is not so much the cars, it's some of
the marketing.
Marketing, and then I hate to say it, not to profile anyone, but the people that drive Subarus that claim they can do far more than they can do. And I do get this a lot.
Honestly, my honest opinion is that I think most Subaru people are pretty realistic about their vehicle's abilities. And the Wilderness Editions are genuinely quite a bit more capable than the standard stuff. Models.
Yeah, yeah.
It genuinely makes a big difference. They add quite a bit of hardware. It's not just an appearance package to make these machines much better than the standard models. But there are limitations to what these vehicles are capable of doing off-road. Obviously, this is not a full-size Bronco competitor. It's obviously not a Wrangler or 4Runner competitor. I think that most people know that.
I hope you're right.
I do agree that at times the marketing for these vehicles goes a little over the top, where they're making it seem like this is your new trail rig to take to Moab, and that is not at all the case. I feel that most people see the marketing, mm-hmm. understand what they're driving at, but also understand that it's not a Moab Rubicon Trail rock crawl.
And that's the comments we're going to get is and I know I'm getting ahead of you people because I know the number one comment's going to be like, Tommy, no one compares this to a Wrangler, right? No one compares this to a Moab machine. But the people I do interact with, I think have a tendency to overstate some capability aspects, and largely based on the marketing. Now, The thing about Subarus, and I'm not only going to call it Subaru, it's also the same way I feel about most of the Rock Creek products from Nissan.
Sure.
The Woodland products.
Pretty much any soft roader with an off-road package.
Yeah.
For the most part.
It's just Subarus, I think, the most bold in their kind of marketing of the vehicle. The thing that Subarus are missing, along with the RAV4 Woodland, even to some extent the Bronco Sport Sasquatch, well, that's a little different situation, is... In my mind, to have a vehicle that I personally am comfortable using, mm-hmm. even on relatively mild situations, the thing it needs is not cladding, right? It doesn't need crazy amounts of auto body protection.
A mild all-terrain tire.
Doesn't need a mild all-terrain tire. It doesn't even need 9, 10, 11 inches of ground clearance. The most important thing I look for if I'm going to go off-roading is...
Low range.
Low range.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
So having an ability to multiply the torque in that engine,
yeah,
for not only the ability to crawl up bigger things, but for the control that that gives you, is the most important aspect.
I agree. And if you're sitting there thinking you guys are wrong, low range isn't that important, hard disagree.
Yeah, hard disagree.
Genuinely hard disagree. Low range is genuinely... I agree with you. I think it is a prerequisite for anything that's going to be half decent off-road. There are some vehicles out there that get impressively far without having a low range, especially some of the more modern transmissions that have 8, 9, 10 gears, where the first gear is geared pretty low. So some machines... are surprisingly good without a low range. I think it was Cole and I went to California to test the new Bronco Sport Sasquatch. Yes, that was. We did a little bit of rock crawling in that. Do we have some of that video? To Ford's credit for this event, some of the stuff that they put us on, and this is a vehicle without a proper low range, some of the things that they put us on with that Bronco Sport Sasquatch was pretty impressive. I was very positive in this video, in my review, because I genuinely like this Bronco Sport Sasquatch quite a bit. And it's not just a honeymoon thing. My girlfriend has an older Bronco Sport Badlands with a rear locker. It's a pretty decent machine. I've taken that on a trail with her. And we did some trails in these that even on camera look pretty reasonably challenging. And the car did pretty well. So there's always exceptions to that rule. But I agree, if you're claiming to have a bona fide four-wheel drive, it's got to have low range. A little later on from here, I think, we did one climb up a rocky slope that was... pretty decent, although I can't remember if that... Was that one that you got out of the car to film? Yeah.
And like, the thing is about the low range thing is, so you can get up the same obstacles that you can get up on a lot of other traditional four-wheel drives, but what you end up having to do is...
Using momentum.
Speed.
Yeah, which...
is problematic.
Yeah, in general, the using momentum thing, not our favorite because it obviously brings in, there it was kind of toward the beginning. I think it ended up just getting used as a B-roll shot in this video. Yeah. So here in a moment, you'll see us cruising up. Look at that.
Pretty steep.
Pretty steep. And again, we were touching the other side of these Bronco Sports.
Yeah. So, there's a lot you can do, right? And I know, and I'm constantly amazed genuinely about what some of these like Instagram Subaru guys can do.
Yeah.
And they've got way bigger balls than I do, which is not saying much because I don't have many big balls.
But to your point, because I've heard you say this in a video before, I think it's pretty funny, but it's also very true. There's a lot of times when we're testing vehicles, especially with how we operate, what we're trying to accomplish, that we intentionally go slow up obstacles because we want it to be difficult. My favorite quote of yours about that is, with enough momentum, you could get up this feature in a Mustang.
Yeah, which is true, yeah.
But that's not the point.
You can get a NASCAR through Moab once, right?
Yeah.
Like, I could do the hot tubs in a NASCAR once, right?
Yeah.
But the car would break and I would break, right? So the whole point of a low range is that it not only gives you more climbing ability, right? It doesn't give you any more traction, but it gives you the control you need
yeah.
to tackle these more difficult things. And even, it's not even like the difficult things. Like the number of times I've been on a mild trail where out of nowhere, it'll go from a 2 to like a 4 or 5 and then back to a 2. And in that brief 3-minute period where you got some bigger rocks or some bigger hills, the amount of heat and stress you can build up in the drivetrain is immense without a low range.
The other thing that I've had happen so many times in vehicles without a low range is you pull up to a steep climb, an obstacle that you're trying to drive up. You're in first gear, so you're in the lowest gearing you can go into because you don't have a low range in whatever vehicle that may be. And you go foot to the floor in first gear, and it's just trying to push up a rock, and it can't do it because you don't have that torque available through all that extra gearing with a low range. So yeah, it is. It's massively important.
And then the thing that you mentioned is interesting too, like that rock example. So then your solution is, well, I can't climb this rock, so I have to take it with speed. Then you approach that rock at, let's say, 5 miles an hour. The suspension compresses, because that's what it does. Then your front end digs into the dirt, right? And then you're either pulling off plastic or you're breaking an oil pan. Or
you get to see the inside of your radiator.
Yeah, you get to see the inside of your radiator. So then you have to make up with that with skid plates, right? Mm-hmm. And then things just, like, it's just a cascade of problems after that.
Yeah, I think it's very easy to make a vehicle look more rugged with a trim package. And those things that are added to it do genuinely make it more rugged. If all you do is take a bog standard crossover and put knobby tires on it, it has more traction. It's now more rugged. But if we're talking about 4x4s, off-roaders, I agree. I think a low range is an absolute must.
So I'm not only calling out Subaru on that, I'm calling out everybody. And there are exceptions. I mean, my two notable exceptions, Bronco Sport, right? And the way you can kind of sort of fake a low range is you make the first gear extra short, right?
Yeah, which they do in the Subaru products.
Yeah. Gear.
Yeah.
CVT. Yeah. But they change the final drive, exactly. Which is great. I think that's an improvement.
Makes a difference.
It does make a difference. And like the four-wheel drive programming is excellent. I've run a Forester Trails
Wilderness
through the slip test, and they're pretty awesome, right? And then like same thing with the Honda Passport. Right, that IVTM4 coupled with that automatic is very good.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying they can't be good. I just like I'm having more and more problems, and I think Subaru is actually not the worst offender, but there's a lot of other worse offenders where they put cladding on. I mean, and like the classic example of that is this model we have on our desk, which is a 1945 Willys Jeep, right? And this is a vehicle, thank you, Case. It has no cladding, right? It really has no skid plates. It has, realistically, I think on ours, we actually own a big version of this, under 8 inches of ground clearance. Not a lot of ground clearance, right? Doesn't have an X mode, doesn't have anything special.
No X mode.
And has 54 horsepower. But what that little Jeep can do is unbelievable.
It is. It's very impressive.
Because of the low range and the lightness.
And there's a lot of things that people talk about in off-roaders that I think are good indications that you're probably dealing with a legitimate rugged 4x4. Things like body on frame, solid axles, things that I love, but I don't think that solid axles or body on frame are as necessary as a low range.
I agree.
Because there are plenty of off-roaders out there that are not body on frame.
Mm-hmm.
Like what? Grand Cherokees, right?
All
the Grand Cherokees.
They're all unibody.
Yeah.
Body on frame is kind of... I've heard a lot of people try to, and someone's going to do it perfectly in the comments, which I encourage.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of people explain the big advantage of body on frame. But in the real world, you can the actual structure of the car is less important than how the suspension is attached to the structure.
For sure.
And I think like with body on frame, it's actually almost advantageous that it has less structure rigidity because you get some more flex in the frame relative to the body. Like you see that on your truck,
right? And I'm not saying there's no advantage of body on frame, but I don't think it's nearly as important as a low range.
And I think like back in the day, unibodies just weren't as stiff or as strong. Sorry. They just couldn't take the abuse that a body on frame could, right? And that I think has changed a lot. I mean, look at like new Defender. Right? It's not as good off-road as maybe like a Wrangler, but it's pretty freaking good with a unibody and independent suspension.
And the same thing with solid axles. I personally am a massive solid axle fan. Two of the four vehicles, so 50% of the stuff in my driveway has solid axles front and rear.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a Disco 2 with a solid front and rear axle and a Cummins with a solid front and rear axle. Love solid axles, but... a well-designed independent suspension can accomplish pretty much the same thing. Case in point, the full-size Bronco, Sasquatch package, disconnecting sway bar. You look at a side-by-side between that full-size Bronco articulating and a Wrangler Rubicon articulating, and I'm not saying the Bronco is better. It's maybe marginally less articulation, maybe, but it would take a keen eye to tell. I remember when we did a video with a side-by-side articulation comparison between the two, people were going back and forth, going at it in the comments, mm-hmm. because it's just not, it's not plain as day. It's not obvious.
Yeah.
So a well-designed independent suspension can also be really effective, but low range, there's no replacing it.
And that brings me to my next underrated car, which is actually a crossover, and it's one we briefly touched on at the beginning, but the previous generation, don't even get me started. Liberties are amazing. I will have that argument in a sec. But on that same line, the previous generation Cherokee Trailhawk. Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing about that is, like, you look at that car and you're like, well, it's just like that Outback Wilderness we just looked at.
Yeah, right? Just a normal Cherokee with knobby tires and cladding.
Exactly, right? It's got some underbody protection, just like the Subaru. It's got some aggressive-ish tires. But then Jeep went to the extra extreme. I mean, I would argue the next important thing to an off-roader other than a low range are recovery points, right? And these had actual recovery points that were rated to the well beyond the GVW of the vehicle.
Okay? Yeah.
And then these actually had a low range, but the way they did it was insane because most of these crossovers are front-wheel drive transverse platforms. What Jeep had to do was give it a low range in the front and then give it another low range in the middle because there's no transfer case, or in the back,
which
because
is a very,
no transfer case.
Very strange solution to the problem, but it kind of worked. It
worked incredibly well. Yeah, so you had two, essentially, quote unquote, two transfer cases, one in the front, one in the back axle, and then they had mechanical locking diffs.
And this is, so this is another one that is going to be chalked up, especially from Tommy, because he's a big fan of these, as an underrated off-roader.
I think these are very underrated. Yeah, the Cherokee Trailhawks are incredible.
Liberty and Renegade as well. I know Tommy likes both of those Jeeps.
Listen, Renegades aren't very good off-road because they don't have the gearing and the power. Mm-hmm. But Liberties are very good off-road. In the development of Liberties, they ran them down the Rubicon Trail.
Yeah. Yeah, so pretty impressive. There is some real baked-in capability there with some of these smaller Jeeps, which is pretty cool. Another category of off-roaders that are now becoming legal in more places, Colorado included, there's legislation coming up that's supporting some of these vehicles, are some smaller Japanese K-car off-roaders, for example. It doesn't even necessarily have to be a K-car. Something like a Suzuki Samurai, mm-hmm. or we tested at one point a very cool one that we did a video on. It was a Mitsubishi Pajero.
Mini.
Yeah, because there's a Pajero Junior and a Pajero Mini, and we did videos on both, but I think the smaller one is the Mini.
Yeah, the Pajero Mini is really cool, and it's basically a Samurai, but with independent suspension and only sold in Japan.
And this was a crazy vehicle. It had like five valves per cylinder and some interesting bits of tech. Was it stick?
It was a stick. I think it was a stick. Yeah.
These are awesome. Any lockers?
No, but it had a low range.
Look at the little hood scoop though. God.
I mean, this one may have even been a turbo model, but they're basically Samurais is what they are. And when you kind of got a momentum, but this is a class of vehicle too, beyond just the K cars, which are exceedingly tiny for American roads.
Yeah.
But this whole like class of small Japanese stuff. So Samurais, Sidekicks, right? Yeah. Vehicles like the Isuzu Rodeos, which may be a little bigger.
Oh, what was the Geo?
The Trackers.
The Trackers,
yeah. So all of these vehicles are kind of in the same vein where they've got the original Jeep formula in that they are incredibly small and lightweight, and that will take them pretty much anywhere.
And this is kind of a cool point because I think the same thing happens with off-roaders that happens with performance cars, where sometimes we get so wrapped up in the pursuit of the maximum amount of performance, we forget that we're not doing this for a living. We're not sponsored. We're only going out to these trails to run these vehicles for fun.
Yeah.
And you can absolutely take a small vehicle like this on a pretty mild trail because with a vehicle like that, even small rocks start to look a little big. And just have fun.
22-inch tall tires, yeah.
Yeah.
But they're incredibly fun and they're incredibly cheap and they're also incredibly reliable.
Yeah. So I think massively underrated because people always talk about what's the best. What's the best off-roader? What about what's the funnest?
The funnest. I like that.
You know?
It's good. This is another off-roader. I don't even know if you knew this. the Suzuki Grand Vitara.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Competed with the RAV4.
Is that actually good?
Yeah, with a low range.
No way.
Yeah, Suzuki Grand Vitaras, that one, the, yes, those last generation, that one as well, they're hideous, but they are incredibly good off-road.
There are some interesting vehicles out of similar era to this that I think most people didn't realize that some of them were body-on-frame, some of them had
like the Kia Sorento. Low range.
Yeah, like the original Sorento or the original Mercedes ML.
Good
that
one.
Was intended to replace the G-Wagon, which is a terrifying thought.
Mm-hmm. It horrifying shot. Glad that didn't happen.
And I'm not... Those two aren't necessarily great off-road because you blew up the transfer case on a pretty mild trail.
I did.
In the ML.
Yes. It didn't like bigger tires, but...
And then we tested a Sorento, a little bit of first-generation Sorento, and it was okay.
Not great. But kind of interesting little bits of history there. And then I've got one more very overrated off-roader, which we'll talk about. It's actually a class of overrated off-roaders. Heavy-duty, four-wheel drive, off-road packages on trucks. So I'm talking like F-250 Tremor, Trail Boss, yeah. Ram Rebel, the 2500 and 3500 versions.
It bums me out to say so because I've got a Cummins that's four-wheel drive. It's on 35s. Well, we'll pull up a video of a more relevant one. We did just take mine to Moab, and I think you were mildly impressed or surprised with what
it was also 30 years old and quite a bit smaller than these ones.
That's true. Some of the modern off-road trim packages on HD trucks they're cool. They look really cool, but you get them on a trail and it feels like you're doing something wrong. Something about it just doesn't seem right.
The problem is what you need for a trail like Moab, Utah, or even like a forest road where you want soft, supple suspension and articulation.
Not on an HD, yeah.
Is exactly the opposite of what an HD truck is designed for, right? Mm-hmm. Which is for hauling and towing capability where you need a really kind of firm spring on it. You don't want a lot of movement in the rear end. So the two are kind of diametrically opposed. And I think some do better than others. Like this Tremor that we that was actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
I thought it did pretty well. But like some of the GM stuff, especially some of the GM like 84X stuff in the past, specifically the HD stuff, it's pretty bad.
I completely understand your stance on these, mm-hmm. but I also completely understand why people buy these.
Those are awesome.
Because, so two things. For one, these vehicles, they're Swiss Army knives. They're work vehicles. So it's something that you could take a road trip in, put all your stuff, put your family in, go long distance, get reasonably good fuel economy if you get a diesel. You could hook up a trailer to it and tow any amount of weight. You could haul around your project car or a camper. You could throw a ton of stuff in the bed, go to Lowe's, Home Depot, pack a bunch of stuff in there, get projects done. And if you get one of these with an off-road package, you can do all of those things, those same things, in more rugged places. This is obviously not meant to compete, again, with a Wrangler or a Bronco or a 4Runner.
Sure.
It's not where they're being cross-shopped. But it's a package that you can add on top of one of these trucks where if you're going to be towing a trailer in Colorado in the winter, the more aggressive tire and the rear locker might get you out of a bind when you're hooked up to a trailer in a dirt parking lot full of snow and ice and mud.
True. Yeah, better tires too. Yeah, that's a great point. But if you're looking for even a mild trail truck, the problem with most of these, and you can see it in the tire placards, right? Like these are designed to be aired up to 70 PSI in some cases, right? So then you've got to air them down to 20, which...
On 35s.
On 35s with a compressor.
20 to 70.
Bit of a weight.
Takes a weight.
And then, I mean, like the best version of the off-road HD truck, I think we probably both agree, is the Power Wagon.
Yep.
Being that for works sure. Mostly because of the thing that people hate about the Power Wagon, and that's the fact it doesn't have a diesel. Because these diesel engines have such an enormous amount of mass over the front end of these trucks, right? It is just so unfortunate when you're off-road.
It doesn't make it any easier to crawl that front end of the truck up a rock feature.
Yeah.
I can tell you from experience.
It's pretty crazy.
Most people can. And they'll do it. You can make it happen. But it feels out of the ordinary.
It's like having an anchor on the front end of your truck.
Yeah, it feels like you're driving over a trail in a building.
Yeah, Or it's just
a massive thing.
A diesel engine will turn an all-terrain into an all-season. You're like, where's all the grip? And it's just because there's so much weight holding it back from forward momentum, right? So Power Wagon doesn't have it. Great, right? And the issue with the Power Wagon, same thing with all the other diesel trucks, and this is more or less not only Colorado, a lot of other places, but the trucks are just so wide.
Yeah.
Right? And most of the trails in Colorado were designed as mining routes that didn't have the Power Wagon in mind in 1894, believe it or not. So they can be really tough to get through trails.
Yeah, and I've been impressed in the past with what people do with them. It's possible. Like Justin King, for example, he has a Power Wagon. Mm-hmm. And I remember when he told us that he took that Power Wagon up Red Cone.
Yeah, I know.
I was impressed because there's some narrow spots on that trail, as there are in many trails in Colorado. So I agree. They're very big vehicles for being on trails, but I still think that some of the off-road gear can add some versatility if you're going to be working and hauling in rugged terrain. So I think I'm for them.
The problem is, as Justin proved, and like we've taken full with trucks up Red Cone like the Hummer EV, is yes, they will do them. Technically, they are wide enough and you can do it. But you spend the entire trail looking out the rearview mirrors. Like genuinely, you just left mirror, right mirror, I'm going to clear that tree. Okay, cleared that tree, left mirror, I'm going to clear. And you never look forward.
Yep.
Like it's an unreal way to off-road these HD trucks in Colorado. You just spend all the time looking behind you, not for stuff behind you, for trees that you just passed.
Yeah, it's definitely not as much fun, but it is a cool sight. So that's one of the tough things when you watch videos of these massive trucks doing trails, lifting tires, spinning tires, and driving over rocks. On the internet, it looks really cool.
Looks damn cool.
But from the driver's seat, it's like,
Yeah. Well, folks, I'm sure, and I know there are a bunch of overrated and underrated we haven't talked about. Maybe we'll keep going in a future episode.
Because we didn't talk about Land Rovers once.
Crazy.
Which is an insane amount of self-control for Tommy and I.
We've got an hour and 8 minutes without
talking about off-roaders.
Not even one Land Rover.
Crazy.
Yep. Well, folks, we'll be sure to do that next time. So you want to stay tuned for that. That's going to be.
You absolutely do.
Absolutely.
We'll give you the scoop.
But as always, this has been Tommy.
And Case.
Head over to Car-ish if you want to find this podcast, but different. And be sure to subscribe to TFL Talk. We got more coming for you soon.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.